Good morning and welcome to Focus 580 on WILL. I'm Jay Pierce, sitting in for David Inch. David returns to the program on Tuesday. In this first hour of the program, if you build them, will people come? And who will come? And if they don't, why not? Some questions which might be asked about projects dealing with public spaces, which are undertaken for a host of environmental, perhaps sociological and economic, maybe political reasons. Greg Lindsay is a person who has explored some of these implications by examining, among other things, a project in Indianapolis to create some urban greenways, an effort to provide natural space. Sometimes these efforts are also encompassing a desire to link diverse neighborhoods. He also looked at an effort in Vietnam to protect a coastal area from ravages of development, while at the same time seeking to more fully develop its potential to attract tourists. We'll see how these compare and contrast in the next hour. Greg Lindsay is Associate Director for the Center for Urban Policy and the Environment at Indiana University, Purdue University at Indianapolis, where he's also an Associate Professor in the School of Public and Environmental Affairs. And he's on campus today here in Urbana to deliver a Friday forum talk at the University YMCA on South Wright Street over the noon hour. His talk is entitled Holy Grails of Sustainable Development, Blue Ways in Vietnam and Greenways in Indiana. And the talk is, by the way, open to the public if you'd like to attend. It's sponsored by the Illinois Disciples Foundation, McKinley Foundation, University YMCA, and Wesley Foundation. It's free. There is, however, if you would like to have lunch, a charge for that. Greg Lindsay joins us now in the studio. And at any point in the conversation, if you'd like to join us, our telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, or toll-free anywhere you can hear us in North America at 800-222-9455. And we say that because we know there might be some of you listening in on the Internet. So anywhere that our signal carries on the AM radio band or in North America on the Internet, 800-222-9455 would be the toll-free number, or 333-9455. In Champaign-Urbana, and of course 9455, if it's easier for you to remember, translates to WILL. Greg, good morning.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, today you have an interesting topic: the Holy Grails of Sustainable Development, Blue Ways in Vietnam and Greenways in Indiana. And in reading through these projects over the past couple of days, I learned quite a bit that one might not even suspect would be some things to think about concerning what a lot of us might consider, at least if we want to start with the Indiana project, something that there may not be a whole lot of downside to: creating greenways trails, open spaces in an urban area. Sounds like a good idea, providing space for people to get out and recreate and enjoy. I mean, you know, it does sound very inviting and like a good idea environmentally, providing public access to some lands, some healthy activities perhaps.
Oh, yes, it is. I think it's a very important project that the city has undertaken.
Why don't you give us a little overview of what the project is, so we can start from there.
Across the country, people are thinking about ways that they can both increase greenery within their cities and increase and improve opportunities for efficient transportation through the creation of bikeways, other activities like other projects like that. In Indianapolis, for the last decade, people have been thinking systematically about how they can contribute to better conditions within the city with this type of a project. It actually dates back to and builds on work that was done at the turn of the century. At the turn of the century, Indianapolis had cut down most of the forest. By the turn of the century, there's only about 1% of the remaining forest. And city fathers determined that it would be a good idea to develop a park and boulevard plan. Mm-hmm. That was planned. And initial plans were made to set aside the parkways, areas along streams and rivers, for open space. Some effort was made to implement that, but it was never done. in the 1990s, a visionary council person said that I think we can return to this plan, this foundation, and try to develop these greenways. And so they undertook a countywide planning process. They held public meetings in river and stream corridors, in corridors along abandoned rail rights of way, in corridor along an old canal, and they talked with people about the types of development they'd like to see. And out of that emerged a plan for a 14-corridor greenway system, seven of which would have publicly accessible trails and seven which would be really designated zones for purposes of conservation that represent essentially overlays over a lot of private property. There were no regulations involved, but the idea is that we're going to try to promote stewardship, try to promote green space, and in these other areas, really try to provide lots of opportunity for recreation and bicycle and other types of pedestrian travel.
Okay. Now, the other project that you studied and will be blended into your speech was on the coast of Vietnam, and this involves a coastal area which is, as I understand it, one of the tourism hotspots, and is undergoing a lot of development. There is an effort to protect some coral reefs, the quality of the water, the beaches, while also exploiting this tourism potential.
That's correct. I had the good fortune in 1999 to be a part of the first group of senior Fulbright scholars to go to Vietnam since the end of the war, and we normalized ties in 1997. And I was assigned to teach at a university called the University of Fisheries, which is in the city of Nha Trang. It turns out that Nha Trang, which is known there as a city by the Blue Sea because of how beautiful the sea is, there's also an archipelago that's renowned for its coral reefs, is the site of the first proposed marine protected area within Vietnam. A marine protected area is essentially an aquatic ecological reserve, but given the nature of the way that developments occur, it's a reserve that's being created over an existing set of uses. For example, about 15,000 people live on the archipelago, and so they have to figure out how to provide opportunities for people whose livelihood that relates to fishing, for example, may be curtailed. In Nha Trang itself, it's a primary tourist destination for foreigners who visit Vietnam and also for Vietnamese tourists. Presently, there's about anywhere from 250,000 to 400,000 tourists who visit annually, and they hope to increase the tourism rate to upwards of 1.2 million by 2010 and 1.8 million. So there's potentially significant stresses on the ecosystem that exist. The question there is whether or not tourism, which generally is viewed as a relatively benign type of economic development activity, can be undertaken without further damaging the coral reefs that exist.
Mm-hmm. Now, how will these to be blended together in your talk in the name of sustainable developments?
Well, that's outwardly, of course, there is little difference, but yeah. I'd like to try to draw some connections. Yeah. The theme of the Friday Forum talk is impossible ideals, mm-hmm. and one of the impossible ideals I'd like to talk about is that of sustainability and sustainable development. And the title of my talk is The Holy Grail of Sustainable Development, because I think that in many ways sustainable development is a holy grail. It's an impossible ideal, and so the link is there. And what I want to do is try to illustrate with these two different examples how, even though outwardly they're very different, there are commonalities. Mm-hmm. And the way I try to link that is that it's generally recognized that despite the problems with getting specific meanings of sustainable development, that it has three dimensions. There's an ecological dimension, there's an economic dimension, and there are dimensions of equity. Mm-hmm. And the question is, how do you balance those in any particular place? When people think about sustainable development, sometimes people think, and in my case, in my opinion, somewhat mistakenly, that there's an ideal state that we can achieve. And instead, I think that we need to recognize that all processes of development are dynamic, they're continually changing, and so we're in positions where what we want to do is influence directions of change. If we want to make development sustainable, then we need to influence directions of change in each of those three dimensions, ecological, economic, and the equity dimension. Mm-hmm. And so the way that I'll try to link these, or the way that I do link those, is that I think about the development processes that are occurring, and I think about how they've I'll try to identify the specific economic objectives in each case, the specific dimensions with respect to ecological improvement, mm-hmm. and the dimensions and what the ramifications are for equity and distribution of both wealth and access to resources.
Okay. Let me give the phone numbers one more time, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana if you'd like to join the conversation at any point, 333-WILL or toll-free anywhere else at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. And Greg Lindsay is my guest. He is the Associate Director for the Center for Urban Policy and the Environment and an Associate Professor in the School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University, Purdue University in Indianapolis. He will be the Friday forum speaker at the University YMCA over the noon hour today. I think that we can understand perhaps what you might be referring to in the way of economic considerations, ecological considerations, but what about this question of equity? What is that about?
Well, equity can be defined in a variety of different ways. Equity can be defined in terms of equal access to resources. Mm-hmm. Equity can divide in terms of equitable distribution of economic resources. And I'll use it in several different ways in the examples that I'll provide, but I'll try to make these general concepts more specific for you. In the case of the Greenway system, is being imposed or created, imposed is the wrong choice of words, it's being created over an existing pattern of development. And, for example, one of the greenways is a historic rail line. Mm-hmm. That rail line can be considered a transect through the city, and we can think about it provides access for people, greater access for those people who live close to it. The quality of access for people who live further away isn't as high. Mm-hmm. So one of the questions that arises with any sort of public investment program like development of a park or development of a greenway system is who will have access to it. Now, I think a common stereotype with respect to activities like trail use is an upper middle class type of an activity. So the question is, are these trails, one of the questions, a relevant question, I think, that when we think about the system, is who will have access to it, and is there equity of access? Mm-hmm. We've had a set of graduate students who have been looking at this in conjunction with the Parks Department so they can answer these types of questions. Mm-hmm. They want, you know, as a public institution, they're concerned about equity of access.
Right.
In this particular case, the case of Indianapolis, because of historic land use processes and where the corridors happen to be, for the 7 greenway trails that have recreational trails, mm-hmm. the proportion of African Americans, for example, adjacent to them is 35%. For the county, it's 21%. And so in this particular case, they've been looking at, is there equity of access, and are there systematic differences between the trail corridor populations and the county population overall? Mm-hmm. In this case, it appears that the poor and the minorities have disproportionate access.
In other words, geographically speaking, a greater amount of the population living along the trails statistically as compared to the county in general, the ratio of minorities to the general population along the trails or adjacent to the trails would be greater.
That's right.
In favor of minorities and lower income level.
That's correct.
Okay.
Now, there's another dimension to it, though. The Greenway system has 5 goals. Mm-hmm. The explicit goals are conservation of resources, recreational opportunities, linkages throughout the community, educational opportunities, and economic development. The goal of linkage is important in both trying to link people in neighborhoods to other parks, to other facilities, to places of employment. One of the other dimensions that we've looked at is how are those populations spread out? And if you look at the pattern of development along the Greenway trails, the work by the students also, our analyses also show that there is significant segregation that exists along the trails. If you start in the outer portions of the county in the outer townships and would trail, for example, on the and would move along the Monon Trail, for example, from north to south, mm-hmm. you'd be moving through neighborhoods that are almost mostly or exclusively white and relatively high income into neighborhoods that are predominantly poor and mostly or 100% black. And so the goal of linkage, there's a challenge to the goal of linkage. There's some work that's been done in the parks and recreation sector that suggests that parks that are on boundaries of neighborhoods that are segregated form boundaries rather than parks that are used. The language, the metaphor that they use for parks like this in those circles are they green walls or green magnets?
Green walls or green magnets. So in other words, the intent may be to develop whether it be a greenway, a trail that goes where the neighborhoods would change as we go along, or a park that would be, as you say, between two different neighborhoods. Instead of being a place that brings people together and would give a diverse experience or multicultural experience, a blending, as it were, of the neighborhoods, they tend to be a barrier, and nobody comes into them?
There's mixed evidence. Mm-hmm. And for example, one paper was done in which people suggested that may occur. Mm-hmm. There's a researcher in Chicago who looked at a park there and found that, no, that wasn't true. That was a magnet. There was interaction. And in any particular place, I don't think that an outcome is a given. And the question is, will it achieve that objective?
Yeah. Okay.
And how will people respond to differences that they perceive as they move through the neighborhoods? Mm-hmm. It also raises the question of whether or not, from an economic perspective, the trails in poor neighborhoods are the highest priority for development, and mm-hmm. whether or not those are the types of recreational facilities that are demanded by that particular population. So there are a host of issues related to trade-offs among these dimensions of economics, equity, and ecology that I think are manifest in the efforts to try to develop this system. I think it's to the credit they're trying to look at these things systematically and address all those. But you know, we'll come back to the theme of the talk today, which is a holy grail of sustainability. We can't maximize for all those variables. We have to make trade-offs among those. And at any given time, the opinions of our leaders who are trying to build those systems may differ. They need to try to respond to people so that they provide people the facilities they want.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that, since we're kind of along these lines concerning the equity issue, one of the things that seems to be a question that comes up over and over, even in a town like this, are the nicer parks relegated necessarily to the higher-income areas or white areas, perhaps, as opposed to minority areas? There seems to be a sustained call in this and other communities for more park space, for more recreational facilities in minority or poorer areas of town. There was some evidence cited in some of your background material here that would suggest that minorities and people in a lower income bracket aren't necessarily the biggest users of those kinds of facilities. So there may be a question of whether it makes sense to make that investment.
Yeah, it goes back to the question of trade-offs that I mentioned a little bit ago. We do not have complete evidence. We don't have, for example, systematic user counts on the sections of the trails that now go through exclusively poor neighborhoods, for mm-hmm. example. We do have some evidence that the rate of use by the poor is lower than the rate of use by mm-hmm. middle class. There are various theories proposed to explain that. Mm-hmm. It does raise the question overall, is that the best use of park dollars in, for example, the city of Indianapolis? Is it best to continue to build a greenway system through the neighborhood so that you try to achieve the objective of linkage? Or, for example, if you develop some sort of an institutional structure in which you let residents of those neighborhoods allocate those dollars, would they choose the same sort of investment? Mm-hmm. It may be, for example, they provide additional community centers that are open different hours rather than the Greenway Trail that closes at night. Mm-hmm. You know, there are lots of trade-offs. And so the question of how we invest these public dollars so that we best meet the needs of particular areas in the city, I think, is an important one that we need to return to again and again.
So maybe a community center would be more important than a park, for instance. While a park sounds nice, maybe that would not fit the needs of the community.
That's possible. Yeah. You know, it's certainly not my decision to make in any particular case, but I think that when you begin to think about ways to achieve different objectives and that meet the needs of people, you need to make sure that those people are consulted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In the case of the development in Vietnam along the coastline, you had mentioned that there are questions concerning the sustainability of the coral reef. It's been harvested for building purposes and otherwise. There are all kinds of perceptions of from a tourist standpoint versus a local resident standpoint. Is the water polluted? Is the beach dirty? You know, what do we need to do to develop this? And then you throw into the pie what kind of a user fee should be established. And I think that's relevant on a number of levels. If you're building if you are going to develop an area for mainly the attraction of tourists, should local residents have to foot the bill for that? And it also raises some interesting questions. It seems that at least a good percentage of the local residents in this particular area that we're talking about are pretty satisfied with the state of conditions.
Well, any time that tourism is proposed as a way to conserve a resource, there's a challenge, and that's determining optimal levels of tourism that can be supported without degrading the resource. In many places, particularly places that are very poor, as is Vietnam, it's difficult to balance these two objectives. In Nha Trang, which already is a tourist destination, people come to use the resource, and there's a question of whether or not it can sustain the levels of tourism that exist. Part of it involves people's behaviors. If you go there and watch, for example, it's very common that you can see people diving and bringing up corals. There's severe stress put on the reefs and reef fish, mm-hmm, through the aquarium and shell trades. The question becomes how to manage people's behavior so that you maximize the probability that you can conserve the resource.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that involves an educational task of understanding where people are in their current perspectives. A thing that we did while we were there to support this proposal is to survey both Vietnamese tourists and foreign tourists to see what they thought about the conditions there. And the results are in some ways not surprising, but they lay out the groundwork for strategy. One of the things that they show, for example, is that culture or nationality has a significant effect on whether or not people perceive that the resources are polluted or being degraded. And so what it means is that to manage the resource, we have to design educational programs for people that are that start at different levels, different messages. Another issue has to do with how we ought to finance these. It's generally recognized that tourism has the potential to fund some activities, but there's also what economists refer to as elasticity of demand. If prices go up too much, you can reduce use. One of the things we're interested in is whether or not tourists are willing to pay additional resources or additional charges to help finance the protection programs. Mm-hmm. And in these cases, it appears that both Vietnamese and foreign tourists are. And so in that case, there's some optimism here.
Mm-hmm. We're at about the midpoint of the program, so let me reintroduce our guest here on Focus 580 today, Greg Lindsay. He was in town and will be the Neunauer Friday Forum speaker at the University YMCA on sustainable development and holy grails of sustainable development, blue ways in Vietnam and green ways in Indiana. is the title of his speech. And Greg is the Associate Director of the Center for Urban Policy and the Environment and Associate Professor in the School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University, Purdue University in Indianapolis. And at least part of the discussion is based on a couple of projects to study greenways in Indianapolis and development in Vietnam, which is a combination of trying to protect a marine area, a coastal area, so that it can sustain ecologically and also to, at the same time, develop the tourist industry there. One of the things that I found interesting goes back again to this question of access and some of the questions that were raised in particular in the study of the greenways in Indianapolis again. And going back to the question of the geographic location of facilities and whether a geographic location will keep some who are not living in proximity from utilizing a facility, a barrier to access on perhaps a perception about the behavior of residents of a neighborhood which might be adjacent to a park or to a greenway. Can you talk a little bit about what you found with that or what questions get raised when looking at that issue?
Well, the work that we've done so far is simply to characterize the neighborhoods mm-hmm. in terms of demographics. The question that the parks, the greenway managers are very interested in is how do levels of use change as you go from one neighborhood to another? Mm-hmm. And their perception is, and it's a hypothesis because they haven't actually collected data on this yet, is that they have sections of trails that aren't used because they aren't readily accessible or because there's concerns about particular neighborhoods. And they base their perception on lots of anecdotal stories. Mm-hmm. Anecdotal stories of somebody riding a bicycle up and shoplifting somewhere, or just perceptions of difference. You can see when you go on the trails that there are significant differences in neighborhoods when you go through. You'll be going along through homes that are priced. You can see homes from trails that are priced anywhere from $100,000 to $200,000, and you'll be in other sections on the trail. There may be significant numbers of homes that are boarded up or structures that are boarded up. And so there are different perceptions that users would obtain when they go through.
Sure. Perceptions of perhaps safety. Maybe there would be a greater risk of, well, and I think people feel it driving through neighborhoods too as neighborhoods change. And it may be a real or a perceived risk, but
that's certainly the case. Now, the Greenways has not done any studies where they've asked people, "Do you not go into this neighborhood because you're afraid of it?"
Mm-hmm.
You know, though that's the sort of work that they're that may be done in the future. People have asked neighbors about whether or not the Greenway has increased or decreased safety concerns, mm-hmm. and the general perceptions of trail neighbors along one trail in a very poor neighborhood is that the Greenway has helped improve conditions. It's brought in more users, and by increasing use, it drives out bad use. A good example of what people believe, whether or not this will actually occur, of course, remains to be seen, is there will be an extension of trail through one section of the city that's very poor. It's an enterprise zone. The abandoned corridor that's there now is one that's used for all sorts of bad purposes. There's mm-hmm. loitering, there's prostitution, there's drug sales. Mm-hmm. At a public meeting there, within the enterprise zone, a majority of people want to see the Greenway built because they want to increase use under the theory that by creating something of value out of a corridor that's not used, it will increase values for the neighborhood. So even though there are questions as you develop it about whether or not people will come, there's clearly a strong belief by the people who live there that this is something they want because they anticipate and think those types of changes will help them.
Mm-hmm. And there is evidence in communities that when a neighborhood is physically changed, cleaned up, abandoned buildings torn down, made to look just better, that that things do improve, that the negative element does move someplace else, perhaps.
That's correct. It's, you know, there's called the disorder hypothesis, and the idea is that if you can improve the, if you can reduce general levels of disorder that are reflected in loitering or reflected in broken windows, mm-hmm. that you can improve levels of use. Mm-hmm. Now, the levels of use are really dramatic. We've done counts of users on the trail, mm-hmm. and on the system overall, and a partial estimate of the total number of users of the trail in Indianapolis exceeds more than 1.2 million people per year. Hmm. To put that in perspective, that's more people than visit or attend all the Colts games and all the Pacers games and all the Indians games and all the ice games combined. Mm-hmm. So there's significant use. People are voting with their feet to use these particular assets. There's a question of what, but that use does vary mm-hmm. dramatically on different trails. Now, one other thing, we're involved in another study to look at how use on trails compare across a set of cities in Indiana. And in this case, we're trying to document levels of use using infrared counters. So every time a user passes by, there's an event registered. Hmm. At one particular location on the Monon Trail in Indianapolis in August, there are more than 60,000 events. And in the peak hours of use, there are people coming by every 4 or 5 seconds. Mm-hmm. So the levels of use are really remarkable in that regard.
So then you would study the various trails and see what the use is on each one,
sure.
and then try to determine perhaps why some would have at peak time somebody going
sure.
you know every 4 seconds, and on others perhaps very little use.
That's correct.
Noticed.
That's correct. For the four trails that have been studied thus far in Indianapolis, the annual usage rates on some are several hundred thousand people per year. On others, it's only tens of thousands of people a year in the 20s and 30s, so that we do get significant variation already.
Have you drawn any conclusions from that? Have you started investigating that,
well,
some of the reasons?
Part of it deals with there's no firm conclusions,
mm-hmm.
no. Part of it has to do with neighborhood. Part of it has to do with trail features, trail characteristics. So, for example, some trails that are not asphalt, that are only soil or crushed aggregate,
mm-hmm.
won't sustain the same type of users.
Mm-hmm.
And so you won't get as many people bringing their bicycles or roller skating on those.
Yeah.
Other trails in different neighborhoods appear to be, poorer neighborhoods appear to be used less. So
mm-hmm.
so that's something, though, that needs to be looked at further.
Yeah, as to why. Let's talk go back to this idea of sustainable development and the possibility. Is there such a thing? It's the holy grail toward it. What are we talking about, first of all, by sustainable development? What is the optimal point that you would reach where you would say this is a sustainable development?
The most commonly cited definition is a definition that says sustainable development is development that supports the needs of the present without compromising the needs of the future.
Okay.
That's a very general type
mm-hmm.
of a thing. And so we said, how can you make that useful?
Yeah.
And we come back to if we accept the proposition that there are the three dimensions of equity, economics, and ecology, mm-hmm. then we look at any particular time, how are we meeting those? I don't think there is a point that is sustainable. I think we need to take a process perspective and look at how those things change.
Mm-hmm.
We need to track things over how they change over time. Let's use the example in Indianapolis. We can ask the question, are these greenways economic? In other words, do they create wealth? Are they used? A couple different economic analyses, benefit-cost analyses of the investments in the greenway have been conducted. The benefits derive mainly from the levels of use. These studies show that the Monon Trail or another project called the Central Indianapolis Waterfront Project,
mm-hmm.
where there's expected to be high levels of use, clearly are economic.
Mm-hmm.
That's without considering any ecological values. Are these things, have these provided equity of access? Well, our analysis shows that, yeah, it appears that there is equity of access. The third dimension becomes, are the greenways green? And in this case, if you actually look at ecological work that's being done along the corridors, you'd be hard-pressed to make the case that the greenways are in fact green, that they are in fact ecological. And here's the argument I want to make there.
Yeah.
And that is that for the most part, there's very little work being done at all to study the ecology of the greenways, let alone to move towards restoration, so you try to rebuild some of the forest that was there over time. One study has been done in one corridor where the quality of the terrestrial forest, the riparian forest, the streamside forest in the greenway was evaluated.
Mm-hmm.
The conclusions were there's nothing natural about it. It's primarily invasive exotic species, and it's highly fragmented by encroachment for urban uses. And so overall, the quality of the riparian forest is very low. It doesn't provide much in terms of habitat values or diversity values. Another colleague of ours did a study to look at aquatic habitat and biodiversity in streams that are on six of the greenways. And it was poor in most of them. It was considered good in only one or two. And there's no work, no investment from the Greenways Division, and very little from the city overall, being put into any sort of stream restoration activities.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though, when we think of greenways, we almost naturally think of the ecological dimension, in truth, the way that's evolving in our city is that's probably the lowest priority overall.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is that a good strategy or not? I think the belief there, and this is one of the similarities that I'll draw between these two disparate cases, is that the belief is that we need to increase recreational value, we need to get people out so that we can build support for then doing something with the environment.
Yeah.
If people aren't using the resources, they won't care about those. That may be a Faustian bargain, but it goes back to the trade-offs among the dimensions of sustainability and how there's tensions among those. And there's not an ideal state. What there are, I think, there are processes that are ongoing, and we need to continually ask questions to see if we can shift and move those in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Looking at the situation in Vietnam as they try to put together this marine protected area, or as it's called, an MPA, how does that fit in as we were talking about the three E's?
Well, here I think that the primary goals in this case, the explicit goals are a combination of economic development and environmental protection, and there's hope that if those are achieved, there'll be greater distribution of resources in an equitable way. There's also hope that you'll provide, by providing economic development overall, you'll increase wealth for the least advantaged there in the city. It seems clear that as Vietnam begins to develop, and if tourism occurs, that there will be improved economic conditions for some people. And my belief after working there for 6 months is that it's absolutely essential that there be infusions of capital associated with activities like tourism if there's to be improvement in economic conditions overall. Now, I think that at the same time, there are very specific measures that people are working towards to protect the resource. Around the archipelago, there will be a buffer zone, an aquaculture zone, a biodiversity zone, and a sanctuary zone.
Mm-hmm.
In the sanctuary zone, for example, the only activities allowed will be research or non-extractive tourism. The question of whether or not they can police that, though, remains to be seen. Right now, many people use dynamite fishing to collect fish. Many people are involved in the aquarium trade. These are things that because they need income. So whether or not in the specific case in Nha Trang, I think whether or not people are able to achieve the goals of protection of the resource depends on how successful they are in the economic sphere in providing alternatives for people.
Mm-hmm. In other words, a source of income for those whose jobs are displaced by stopping dynamite fishing or stopping harvesting of tropical fish off the coral reef sale for aquariums.
That's right. There need to be other jobs mm-hmm. that provide people reasonable livings,
mm-hmm.
or otherwise the sort of extractive activities that now are going on will continue.
Another aspect that was pointed out, too, was the perception of whether the souvenir salespeople, and I would imagine these would be local residents selling various souvenirs on the beaches, was an attraction for tourism.
Yeah, there are a number of issues related to sort of the expectations of foreign tourists and the understanding of people in the country of their expectations. There are two things we can talk about. There are lots of small shops, vendors, people selling things. If you walk down one of the streets adjacent to the beach, there's walls of lacquered turtles. These are sea turtles that they're trying to preserve, but they're prized by many people for ornamental purposes. Mm-hmm. So one of the questions, you know, a number of foreign tourists, high proportions of foreign tourists who come there are interested in preservation of those. So there's when they see the active markets for these species that they would like to see preserved, mm-hmm. there's tension.
Yeah.
Another example is you can walk down the streets and see aquariums filled with live seahorses. At the same time, many governments are working with the Vietnamese to try to conserve the seahorses. There's an active market because many people in Asian countries consume them for medicinal reasons.
Hmm.
So there are trade-offs there. Now, a third issue comes to just sort of expectations along, and how the beaches are used.
Mm-hmm.
The municipal beaches there in Nha Trang are publicly accessible, and many people make their living by hawking T-shirts or food to recreationists. Some beaches have become private. The government has licensed a private firm to use a section of beach, and they've essentially made that exclusive there. And the vendors aren't allowed to go there. They've done that in part because many tourists have complained about the number of beggars, the number of vendors who try to sell them things. And so one of the questions in developing a tourism industry has to do with reconciling, again, the needs of the people who are trying to earn a living with the expectations of the tourists that are there, mm-hmm. and managing the tensions that mm-hmm. inevitably may result.
But to some, the culture of those kinds of marketplaces is very attractive.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
Well, it part goes through something that tourism experts call the tourism-like cycle, life cycle. When tourism in a place that is initially developing, it may be considered ecotourism, many of the people who go revel in rougher conditions
mm-hmm.
and enjoy the sort of interaction that they experience.
Yeah.
As they move toward what's considered mass tourism, and that's certainly the objectives here in Nha Trang, as they hope to quintuple the number of foreign tourists, people come to expect easier circumstances, more mm-hmm. luxurious circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And so and people have documented in places where this has occurred increasing tensions at that point mm-hmm. among the recreationists and the local population. And so the question becomes how to manage that in a way that these goals of economic development, conservation of resources, are achieved.
Some would call that a more sanitized environment.
Certainly.
Like moving Miami to Vietnam. You know, why go all the way across the world to visit Miami?
Certainly, there's all kinds of tensions.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, there's no idealized state. You know, that's why, you know, I want to come back to the idea that we need to think about sustainable development mm-hmm. from a process perspective.
Yeah.
I don't think they'll ever achieve some state in which we say, okay, these resources are protected. We don't have to worry. That's just not going to happen. There are going to continue to be tensions between people who visit the area, people who live in the area, the goals of economic development, the goal of ecological conservation.
We have just a few minutes left, and I thought maybe we could look at where you go in the future. Taking the studies that you've done, the projects that you've been looking into, what's your next step?
A couple of things. One, now I'm working with some colleagues at IUPUI to try to develop an affiliations grant with other institutions in Vietnam, so we can continue work there. It was rewarding for me personally to be involved, and I'd like to continue that.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that I've done back in Indianapolis, as a way to try to support the efforts to develop and build a greenway system is set up and run at the university there. I call it a standing workshop on greenways management. And what we do is every semester I'll have a team of students who will undertake some analytic project, some sort of a research project for the greenways system. What this enables them to do is provide research that supports their efforts without, given the resource constraints that they operate under. So one of my objectives is to continue to do research to help them document levels of use, help them look at whether or not the impact, to help them document the types of impacts that use are having on their system, and then look at how use patterns vary and try to explain those patterns.
Mm-hmm. And today you'll be speaking in the noon hour on the topic of holy grails of sustainable development, and talking about the projects, the studies that we've been getting a little more in-depth into today, Blueways in Vietnam and Greenways in Indiana. And again, if you'd like to visit and take in Greg's speech, you can for free. If you'd like lunch, there is a charge for that, but this will be the Friday Forum speech at the University YMCA on South Wright Street. And Greg Lindsay is Associate Director for the Center for Urban Policy and Environment and an Associate Professor in the School of Public and Environmental Affairs, Indiana University, Purdue University in Indianapolis. And good luck on those future endeavors. And thank you very much for stopping by the studios today.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Once again, that'll be the Friday Forum Talk, and that is at the University YMCA over the lunch hour today. There's more coming up on Focus 580 after we take our break here for a commodity market update and National Public Radio news coming up in the next hour of the program. Yesterday, we had the Republican candidate in the 19th Congressional District on the air with Carl Caldwell for an open line in the 10 o'clock hour of the program, James Etherly. And today, in just about about 15 minutes or so, we'll welcome into the studios the 19th District incumbent, the Democrat, David Phelps, who is running for re-election for that seat. And we'll invite you to pick up the telephone and call in on an open line and ask the questions of the candidate that you would like to receive answers to in this campaign. It's part of our effort to make the candidates accessible directly to you, unfiltered by the media. So instead of the reporters asking the questions, it's your turn to ask the questions today. And we'll invite your calls for Congressman Phelps following our commodity market update and National Public Radio news.